All right, welcome everybody to News in the Money World. How are you, Rupert?
I'm very well. How are you, Darcy?
Fantastic. I've never felt better, in fact.
How's the health issues?
Health issues, yes. But they have been literally removed. If you've ever had kidney stones, you don't want them. But now that they're gone, I'm feeling much better. I'm feeling about 4 millimeters lighter. So let's talk about more less invasive things like interest deductibility, returning to the New Zealand property market, Bitcoin with the ETF inflows spiking up. We have core inflation remaining stubbornly high, hinting at higher for longer interest rates. And then finally, if we can get there, we'll finish up on stagflation. So shall we start with property?
Yeah.
Yeah. This is obviously really close to my heart, big property fan. And I think with a lot of the changes that were imposed by the previous government with removing or carving out interest deductibility for the business of providing long-term rental accommodation, i.e. property investing, that seemed to be a little bit of a punitive move back in the day. So it's encouraging to see that things are simplifying and that the playing field is in fact being leveled, simplified. And 80% for next financial year is what we'll be able to claim in terms of interest deductibility. That makes things a little less painful. We still have all the other costs associated with this mandatory improvements that we were forced to make. And these are good things. And obviously much, much higher interest rates. But this is going to help. It's not necessarily going to bring rents down, but it will introduce a little bit of disinflationary pressure to rents, is my suspicion. Your thoughts overall, Rupert, on property? You might come from a slightly different perspective from me, so I'd be keen to...
Yeah, I probably, coming back to my socialist roots, the lack of interest deductibility was absolute bullshit. There's no question on that. The truth is that owning homes is a business, right? And so therefore, interest is a business expense, so therefore it should be deductible. I'm never going to debate that one. Do I think that deducting interest is going to kind of bringing back deductibility is going to change rents and bring rents down? No way. And I think this is the bit that I kind of struggle with quite a lot. Time and time again, we keep on saying the core driver on rents is supply and demand. And so therefore, if it's supply and demand, the only thing that's going to bring down rents is if we start building a hell of a lot more houses. I think it was the right move to bring to make this change and the right move to kind of bring back deductibility because it is a business expense. But let's cut the bullshit. There is no way it's bringing down rents.
Yeah, yeah. There's no way that it's going to be solving really any underlying problem. Apart from, I guess, just making things a little bit clearer out there. And I guess the other bit that I've been wondering about with this change is that previously there was a carve out which made interest deductibility all okay for new builds. And I remember kind of being a little bit concerned when those rules came out because I knew that that would create some distortions and artificial demand for new build properties. And my concern is that now perhaps that the level playing field will happen between new builds and pre-existing. Remember, pre-existing properties are often they're more likely to be in limited supply areas, which from a capital gains perspective is really important. And so now that this leveling is going on, I wonder if we might see some downward pressure in terms of property prices on new builds even more. Who knows? But that, once you reduce that, it could be all sorts of distortions.
Oh, no, no. And I think you're right. I mean, it has the potential to. But I think the rules and the complexities made it so much harder. It'll be really interesting to see. Fundamentally, we just need to figure out a way to build a hell of a lot more houses. I think the other thing upon reflection, which is kind of interesting in my book, is we keep on talking about the need and the want to professionalize the rental market, right? Because at the end of the day, you're providing accommodation. You're providing someone's life. And we are in how kids grow up is arguably one of the biggest determinant of how they end up in life. And so that's kind of the bit that I probably struggle with a little bit. On one hand, we were making it less professional by saying it's not a business, so therefore deduct interest. But at the same time, we're creating all of these rules that make it harder for landlords, which I actually 100% agree with most of those rules, because fundamentally housing is a right and it's not something that should just be done as an afterthought for someone's retirement. It needs to be a professionally managed, well thought out thing, in my view at least.
Okay. All right. Well, let's move on. Good timing. I always feel the fire kind of burning in my belly when I hear, you know, it's a human right. So we'll move on from that.
Okay.
Bitcoin. Let's talk about Bitcoin. Let's talk about BlackRock. Let's talk about Vanguard as well. But let's talk about Bitcoin firstly, because it's been one of those assets that's been on a tear, especially recently, hitting new all-time highs. I think there was one post that I saw on X where it was somebody said, every time I go to sleep, the price goes up by $5,000 US. And so I instantly reply back, when are you going to sleep next? It seems, but that's kind of how volatile this asset is, right? So it's $72,000 US, I think, at the time of recording still, but it'll change. And why that's important that it is volatile, especially in the upward direction, is that it can provide a really good boost to the overall portfolio performance without significantly increasing the risk. So to me, it makes sense. BlackRock agrees. BlackRock, for those that don't know, largest fund manager in the world, and they're now planning to purchase spot Bitcoin exchange traded funds for its $18 billion global allocation fund and $36.7 billion in the strategic income opportunity funds. So what is this going to mean, especially when passive funds are going to get increasingly involved and just keep on plowing money towards Bitcoin no matter what the price is? What does this mean, Rupert?
Well, a couple of weeks ago, we talked about the beauty about these ETFs is that we were going to start to see institutions now buy it, because a lot of the impediments to buying are going to kind of be removed through this. Mm. And this is exactly what we're seeing, right? I mean, you think about, say, that BlackRock strategic fund, a $36 billion fund. At the end of the day, if they just put 2% into that fund, that's $700 million. That is a huge amount of volume in new investor interest. And that's only one fund. And so I think, are we at the start? I mean, I thought it would be kind of going more into the hedge funds and those worlds who like to play the volatility games. I suspect that is what we are seeing right now. But at the same time, yeah, it's great, because the thesis is starting to play out as an investment class. It is becoming more and more normalized. And the beauty about kind of the current kind of ramp up in value is it's pretty hard to argue. It's pretty hard to argue that it is kind of becoming a part of it, right? And so, yeah, look, hopefully this is the first of many. And I think that what you talked about, it's a really great way. I think a small allocation is actually a great way, particularly given that volatility, it can materially change the returns on a portfolio, right? And just kind of before we came online, we were talking about some of the stuff that we're seeing in our fund, where kind of the price is kind of up 160% over the last kind of 6-9 months. And what we've just been doing is we keep on rebalancing, we keep on taking the top off. And so we've had lots of clients that still have an exposure to crypto, but actually all their initial capital has now been kind of moved out of crypto and into other funds because of the way we're rebalancing. And so I think increasingly we can become more sophisticated in how we do it, and we can become a really great at how we manage the risk on the way through. And that's what we're going to start seeing, right, as it becomes more of a mainstream asset class.
That's awesome. What are your thoughts, though, on Tim Buckley? So Tim Buckley, the former CEO, I guess, of Vanguard, was on board with this. And Vanguard is still on board with this decision to not allow their investors to get access to Bitcoin through their products. And there was a quote here from Janelle Jackson from Vanguard. While crypto has been classified as a commodity, it is an immature asset class that has little history, no inherent economic value, no cash flow, and can create havoc within a portfolio, kind of the opposite of what we just said. What are your thoughts on that? Like, do you think Vanguard is making this a little bit of a dangerous decision here?
No, to be blunt, because I think most people, to be fair, there's two points to it, right? Well, number one is, a lot of the Vanguard funds and the Vanguard strength is that they are used by advisors and a lot of other people in the world to pick and mix. And you kind of go, so I think for them as a business and as a business model, last I looked, which to be fair is only a couple of years ago, of their many trillions, only $50 billion or so is kind of direct investors on their own platforms. And so that puts that business at risk, but I don't think it puts the rest of the business at risk or does much. What we have seen is Bitcoin is actually going to become a pretty low margin commodity style ETF. I mean, the fact that you got Fidelity waiving all fees for 2 years or 1 year, sorry. You got BlackRock kind of only charging half the fees. You got the total expense ratio is expected to be 25 basis points. I mean, yeah, there's a lot to be said about it's not going to be a profitable product for anyone, is my view, given the custody costs and other costs that are there. So I kind of understand it. I think there will be over the next 12, 18, 24 months, the continual conversations, right? Just because we're getting some people across the line doesn't mean that the rest are going to kind of just fall into place immediately. And I think that's what's kind of really interesting about where we're sitting. Yeah, it's the conversations aren't going to change. It's just going to come all of a sudden we're going to get a mountain of traditional people and kind of some of these voices are going, actually, you know what? I'm no longer skeptical. I now believe in it. And you, but that's going to kind of mount up. And on the other side, you're still going to have the detractors, but hopefully the tone kind of shifts over time. As much as we'd like to win overnight, it's never going to happen.
Yeah, good point. And at the very least, we now have choice, right? Like we actually have variety. We have innovation. It's cool.
And that's the most important part, right? We've talked a little bit about treating investors like adults, letting them make their own decisions, letting them make their own informed decisions. And I think that's why full respect to BlackRock, Fidelity by allowing it in their 401k plans. It means that actually our job as fund managers, our job as providers of financial products is to give people the choices. The more we talk about, actually, no, it's too dangerous, stay away from it. Actually, all we're doing when we do that is keeping people away from the traditional financial system. And I don't think that helps consumers, and that definitely doesn't help firms like ours in the long term either.
You nailed it. Absolutely agree. Okay, so let's talk more around a macro or get into the macro space here a little bit. And by that, I mean understanding what's happening with interest rates, primarily in the US, where a lot of our portfolio will be invested. So that's quite important to understand that. But also here in New Zealand, there's definitely some synchronicity with central bank policies. And so we kind of need to understand both if we're going to understand what's happening here in New Zealand, and that will affect our mortgage rates. So starting with the US, we've seen an inflation print in terms of their core inflation. This is the stuff that really, I guess, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that the policy out of the US Fed directly impacts the core inflation, because that's influenced by money printing effectively and historical money printing that has been off the charts over the last 4 years. So of course it's going to linger for a while. Of course markets are going to seem incredibly overvalued for a season. All the markets are telling us though is that our currency has been debased. That's my view anyway. And so if we look at maybe a tipping point, it kind of feels like it's being pushed further away. I want to get your views on where you think this great disinflationary tipping point is, where we are now not accelerating in terms of price increases, but we are now hopefully leveling off and maybe decreasing the rate of increase. What are your general thoughts here? Do you think that things are going to get back into control this year, or do you think maybe it is going to be higher for longer in the US?
I suspect it might be higher for longer than we expect. And the reason I say that is it's the unemployment rate. At the end of the day, the big inflation, the inflationary drivers at the moment are more in the services sector than they are in the core consumer goods and the core goods sector. And so what does that mean, right? So that means that services is the major cost in services is people. We've still got unemployment at record lows. And that means that we are still seeing wage prices grow in that kind of 3-6% range, right? Late last year, we in the US, we were down at 4.5%. In Q4 in New Zealand, we're at 6% kind of wage growth. That is not an environment that you can kind of, that you're going to get out of this inflation spiral. The only way we're going to be able to do it is once we start to see the unemployment rates ticking down. And so I think we talked last year a lot about how the last hurdle is likely to be the hardest, and that's what we're starting to see right now. And we saw it this morning, right, where kind of the US and the inflation print out of the US did actually show a further uptick in inflation, so we'd no longer have that immaculate disinflation. Admittedly, today's driven a lot by housing and shelter, which, because markets want to, they've managed to normalize out of saying, don't worry about it, it doesn't actually mean anything. But yeah, I increasingly I'm taking the view that probably the rate hikes are going to take longer to come in than we otherwise would have expected. And because the other thing, the rate drop, sorry, because I think there at the moment the data is still way too strong, and we haven't seen the data there. And then when we get to June, July, then we start into this this world of an election, right? So November presidential election, there is no way that the Fed wants to be seen to be interfering in the election. And so even though it's not official, you're going to end up in a bit of a blackout period for kind of historically, the Fed has always kind of gone into a little bit of a blackout period for that 4 or 5 month period or 3 to 5 month period ahead of the election. And so we're very quickly running out of time before the Fed can act and can do stuff. And I think that's where it's kind of gets pretty interesting, right? And given what they're seeing on wages, given what they're seeing on services, I don't see them doing anything until they see that unemployment number spike. And that's going to mean that hopefully that's going to be the indicator on when wage prices turn.
Wow.
Wages turn.
So really what you're saying here is that we have this blackout date that's really quickly approaching, and we don't have the required justification for the Fed to drop yet. So we kind of need to see an even bigger justification, probably in the form of a spike in the unemployment rate, which is probably inevitable, right? Like if they keep on with this course setting, it will force them to make a move probably within that blackout period. But as long as they can point definitively at that reason, then I guess they can't be blamed for interference, right?
Yeah. Well, I challenge you on another slight little thought, right? What is neutral? What is neutral? What is the neutral interest rate, right? Is it 4 or is it 5? Or is it kind of, we're at 5.5 at the moment, right? In the US as well, 5, 5.5. And 10, 15, 20 years ago, no one would have thought, everyone would have argued, you know what, that is pretty neutral and that's probably kind of not a bad estimate of where long-term sits there. And so if you go 2% inflation, 3%, 2.5%, 3% real GDP, yeah, 4.5 to 5, actually. And so that's going to be one of the other things that's going to be going through the Fed's mind, particularly when you look at what's happening economically, where this year we are actually banking on above trend growth.
Right.
And so, there's a bit of stuff there that kind of, to me, increasingly I'm taking that view that we might actually be in a slightly higher for longer than we expect. Or the only thing that's probably going to fix that and change the view on that is an economic shock, which, let's be honest, that's not going to be good for markets either. World of interest rates coming down, economic growth staying strong, economic corporate earnings kind of continuing to grow at kind of 6-7%. That's a triangle that I don't think kind of can go together.
Interesting. Yeah. The only thing that I would add there is that as, I don't know if this would be the right graph to watch, but M2 money supply growth and the neutral rate, right? Like as the overall level of debt gets higher out there in the system, it just requires a very small amount to have a massive aggregate impact. And maybe that's what also the Fed is mindful of, is that there's 12 to 18 month delay, which is right about now, where it should start to hurt. Like you stub your toe, you wait for like a couple of microseconds and then you feel the pain. That's kind of what's happening right now. We're really feeling that pain.
Well, and this kind of brings us to the New Zealand story, right? Because, again, I was at an interesting presentation last week where there's a few people are starting to say, is New Zealand the canary in the coal mine? So New Zealand, we went earlier on, I think we were 3 to 6 months earlier on rate hikes than anyone else.
Yeah.
Let's be honest, I'd be very surprised if the data doesn't come out showing that we are in recession. And we are kind of, we probably in a world of stagflation here in New Zealand, we've got kind of wage growth at 5-6%. We've got kind of negative growth. And yeah, so it's a pretty ugly environment for us here in New Zealand right now. Is this because we're 6 months ahead of the curve? Or is this because of underlying factors that are kind of New Zealand centric? I'd actually argue when we look at a lot of the factors that have driven New Zealand over the last kind of 3 years, 4 years, they're no fucking different to what's happened in the US and in Europe, right? Massive government stimulus, low interest rates. And so that's the bit that I don't quite get, right? And this is where I struggle a little bit in New Zealand. I think in New Zealand, we might be closer to interest rates relief than kind of others are predicting, is because the state of our economy, we are starting to see the layoffs. We are starting to see kind of anecdotally, you're kind of seeing people going, no more wage growth, no more kind of, actually, we promise we'll protect jobs versus give wage growth. And so what that probably means is that we are about to see the tick up in the unemployment rate, which means that we will get kind of that wage growth slowing to stopping, which means the inflation comes down, which means they can be confident on interest rates. The big difference here, though, between here and what's happening in the US, ours is being driven by recession. And in the US, they're now saying, most people are now agreeing there will be no recession. And so that's the dichotomy that I think is kind of interesting to pass and figure out where it goes.
Yeah, such an interesting and complex world at the moment, where we have mixed signals that indicate the market is about to crash and the recession is imminent, and then other stories that would indicate the complete opposite. All the while, we have tech stocks, the Magnificent Seven, being 30% of the S&P 500, just holding that bad boy up to record highs, and it just looks like everything's all good there. So there's all these mixed signals, and I just wonder which of those forces will be the dominant force that carries us through. Crazy, right?
It's a fascinating one, though, right? But this shows how pervasive the idea of soft or no landing is now in the US. So February, the S&P equal weighted index, so it means that kind of the 500 companies that sit there, every company is weighted at 0.2%, so we're not getting this massive tech overweight. It hit its record high. So actually, the market rally has broadened right out. It hasn't gone as low as the Russell 2000. People are pretty nervous about what's going to happen in the small cap space, because those companies are typically far more at risk from higher interest rates. But it is kind of, it has broadened right out, this idea of no recession. It's clearly mainstream, and people talking about recession are now seen as the extremists rather than the other way around.
Yeah, which is great. So that's an interesting concept, though. Not a concept. It's an interesting observation or a fact that the technology boom, let's say, and that's drilled down further, AI within technology, within the broader index, there's a spillover effect where when one sector does well, maybe it's through the action of rebalancing where people are selling their overweights, buying the underweights, spreads it out, broadens out the overall performance. That's really similar to what happens in the crypto space as well, where we have this four-year halving cycle. Bitcoin goes on a tear. Obviously, it's a premature tear at the moment, but that is already having the impact of boosting altcoins. There's alternative words for that, but I'll keep it PG. And it's interesting, right? So you have this sloshing around of money within financial systems, which keeps it away from the real economy so long as number go up. But my suspicion and my question mark that I haven't resolved this yet is, if there was a clear indication that markets were leveling off, or we were into a long flat period, yet we remain in this inflationary space, like everyday people are still struggling to buy stuff, would that lead to a sell-off in markets, and then people take that money out of the financial system, which then creates another wave of inflation? Do you see that as a possibility?
Yeah, I think definitely. And that's one of the concerns, right? That the amazing set of financial conditions makes people feel rich all of a sudden, right? So it's not necessarily even taking out. It's going, I'm happy to top up on my mortgage. I'm happy to take a little bit of credit card debt because all of a sudden my Bitcoin holding has gone from being worth 20 grand to kind of 60 grand. And yeah, there is a lot of that that kind of does place risk. One of the things that was really interesting, a chart I saw last week about the US, through all of the stimulus programs and the lockdowns, there was like people ended up with three and a half years worth of disposable income saved up through all of that, right? And so, and that's been the challenge. That's now run out though. That's kind of, we're now down to about 0.2 years of disposable income that's waiting. And so to your point, exactly that. The disposable income was there sitting in bank accounts because that was the stimulus money, that was all those kind of things. Now, do they go, actually, they've had a pretty, those that had invested some of that, those that had put that away, have had a great run on that money. I mean, and do they go, well, actually, cool. Time's pretty tough. Things are expensive. I'm kind of nervous about kind of my jobs, kind of, and actually, you know what? It's going to sell out and that's going to give me a next wave of disposable income.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it just, again, speaks to that delay effect and that the cushioning that we have and the fact that, yeah, New Zealand probably needs to have lower rates and sooner. I still have, if this turns out to be that New Zealand follows the Fed, I will then not be so crazy with my theory, but I'm pretty sure that the Fed will lead and New Zealand will follow suit. But that's looking increasingly unlikely just because we'll need to drop.
Yeah, well, the one, yeah, I mean, the thing I'm fascinated by on the RBNZ, right, is what happens in Christmas. But if we get through to the end of the year and we're in a pretty ugly world of stagflation where we've got, we're still in recession or skirting recession, interest rates are still high because we've still got inflation there, what does the government do? Do they all of a sudden start beating the shit out of Adrian Orr and going, you have to reduce rates? You have to reduce rates because basically the population and everyone becomes extremely unhappy. I'm kind of fascinated, right? Because what we've seen over the last 3 or 4 years is the politicization of central banks. And let's be honest, our government's no better than any other government at that either. Well, arguably Trump's actually a whole lot worse, but putting him aside, we've still got Winston Peters and David Seymour's becoming increasingly populist by the day. So I go, actually, is the conversation going to do a complete 180? And actually, the national coalition turn around and go, hold on a sec, guys. You now need to take into account unemployment. You need to do this. You need to do this because your singular focus on inflation is absolutely crushing the economy and crushing people, which means we're not going to get voted back in.
Well, okay. Let's put a pin in that one.
let's get that one. We'll come back and revisit that one towards the end of the year. But I think it's going to be fascinating to see where we go, right? Whether politicians have the wherewithal to see this through. And I'm not convinced they do.
Yeah. Okay. Let's keep on watching that. That is fascinating. Well, there's plenty to talk about, isn't there? And
I thought we were going to have a quick, quiet one, but clearly not.
And there's still a few points, but we'll say that for next week. And I'm sure there's going to be some stuff added to between now and then as well. We haven't really talked about the BTFP, the Bank Term Funding Program, that came to an end like 1 or 2 days ago. So that's something right there. Commercial real estate, NVIDIA. Like there's these little stories that I watch to see whether they're going to become mainstream or not, and they haven't really yet. So I kind of hesitate a little bit as to whether we bring it up. But I think as time goes on, we probably need to. So maybe that'll be next week.
The other one I'd like to talk about next week is the China-Australia relationship, because I find that fascinating, right? And actually, the Australian economy will either be the biggest beneficiary of what's happening in China or the biggest... what's the negative on beneficiary or the biggest loser? That's probably a better word, blunt word, but and that's the bit that I kind of go, I just don't know which way it's going to last. And so that's a great conversation I'd like to have too, because that's going to have big implications for New Zealand.
All right. And if anyone's listening and they want us to cover a certain topic a certain way, I think between Rupert and I, we have fairly diverse enough views on things. We could probably flesh it out a little bit. So let us know. That's awesome. Okay. Well, thank you everyone for listening in, and thanks for your attention today, Rupert, despite the technical difficulties that we had. We'll catch up next week.